This is MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's Russ White.
Here's a still timely 2011 conversation between Michigan State University President Luana Simon and Spartans Athletic Director Mark Hollis with their counterparts from Ann Arbor, University of Michigan President Mary Sue Coleman, and Wolverines Athletic Director David Brandon.
We're really privileged today to have Mary Sue Coleman and Dave Brandon from our colleagues at the University of Michigan. For most days of the year, we're great colleagues. There may be a couple where we are on opposite sides of the field, but it really has been a terrific partnership I've had with Mary Sue for a very, very long time, and I know that the relationship between Mark and Dave has been growing. So it's a pleasure to welcome you, and we thought we'd just talk a bit about innovation and how that affects universities and also athletic programs.
Thanks, Luana. I want to second that fact that you and I have known each other for quite a long time, and I've really valued the partnership that we have, because in this day and age, as the state's trying to reinvent itself, for universities to turn toward innovation, entrepreneurship, all those activities that we've done together through the University Research Corridor, I think is a real plus for the state, but it's really good for us and for changing our culture within the university.
You and I, Mary Sue, have been around probably longer than we want to admit on the radio, but for a land-grant university, we've been involved in the connections, and people think about the agricultural in ecosystem and our role, but places like the University of Michigan, University of North Carolina, where you've been, Iowa, New Mexico, they all were engaged in this innovation cycle.
You know, that's really right. And one of the things that I've seen over the last decade, particularly, and it's accelerating, and land-grant universities have always kind of had this feature, but universities like Michigan are really picking it up, and that is to really try to play more in that intersection of the theoretical to the practical. Make sure that discoveries are getting out into the marketplace. Make sure that our students have an opportunity to really engage in entrepreneurship. And one of the things I like so much about the University Research Corridor is that, you know, we and you, along with Wayne State, can really share what we've learned about tech transfer, about doing venture accelerators, about really trying to change that dynamic in the state and diversify the economy. So I think it's the sharing and the open collaboration that has been so beneficial to me. And I think we're coming to the table after you did, but it's fun to see it all evolve together.
When I think about the 150th anniversary of the Morrill Act that we'll celebrate this year, it will have one meeting in terms of access, but it was all this commitment to economic development was very much a part of this land-grant movement. And as I think about the future of the 21st century, what we're talking about is cutting-edge knowledge, and it takes all of us with this now, more not by founding of land, but by spirit of commitment to this innovation cycle and the connections of the community, as Michigan is doing now, Michigan State for, as well, that we can all work together to really try to bend the prosperity curve.
You know, I agree with that, absolutely. And the thing that is so astonishing to me is that this takes hold in the culture of the university. I was really surprised to learn that last year we had more than 5,000 students who participated in some way in some entrepreneurship activity, whether it was a course, whether it was doing something in an accelerator, whether it was our 1,000 Pitches competition. So that I think this culture change is really, it's suffusing the institution across LSNA as well as the places you might expect, business and engineering. And I think it's that strength. And I know that among our student organizations that we've had outreach across institutions as well. So that's kind of exciting to see that all happen.
It is. And I think when we talked about the URC, you know, we really did envision this network of students, faculty, staff, our alums coming together to be able to change Michigan and therefore change the world. And so it's been fun to watch. And we have two athletic directors who now want to play golf together and and compete, but are also interested in changing the world.
Well, I think the one thing you go back to is, you know, whether it be Big Chill the movie or Big Chill the hockey game, you have athletic directors that are viewing things much differently in what role we can play with the public nature of our area of expertise and how we can bring components, whether it be FRIB on our campus or the many great things that you're doing down there. I know both Dave and I are looking on a daily basis. How can we take the public notoriety of our coaches and our student athletes and really put our institutions out to the forefront. And when you can do it collaboratively, it has all that much more power within the state of Michigan. Dave, you agree?
I totally agree, Mark. And we are an economic development engine in and of ourselves. These studies that have been done to show just what the sport of football means when home games are hosted either in Ann Arbor or up in East Lansing, the amount of revenue, the amount of activity that it brings to the retailers, transportation industry, the housing industry, it's an amazing impact. And so we need to continue to build our brands and bring more people to town for more events, and that does our part in terms of the economic health of Michigan.
Mary Sue, I know that you were involved in a wave of NCAA athletic reform in your years as a president, and how do you view the current landscape?
Well, you know, I might turn that question back to you, Luana, because you've been more deeply involved recently than I have. But, you know, I realize that this is part of an ongoing process, and it's a challenge. But I think institutions have to step up and demand the changes. And I was quite encouraged. I wasn't able to attend, but I think you were there in this summit that the NCAA held this summer for university presidents on some things that need to change within intercollegiate athletics. It's always going to be a challenge for us, but I'm encouraged at least that there's a will to get some things right that perhaps need to be altered. And you and I both talked about this, is that we now have a rule book that is almost unmanageable. And I do believe there needs to be some thoughtful consideration of what the rules are going to be, prioritizing the rules, what are the most important, and so that we can all figure out how we can really comport to what we all want to have happen. Because after all, the NCAA is a membership organization. It is us.
Dave, we have a great group of athletic directors in the Big Ten. 12 of us sit around. We all come from different backgrounds. And one of the comments that you made in the meeting was kind of that comparison between how things operate in intercollegiate athletics versus how they operate in private business. Some of that was specific to maybe some of the negative issues that develop and how the corporate world has changed to address that, and maybe some examples that we in intercollegiate athletics sort of need to look to as we move forward in the future.
Well, Mark, the point that I was making is I was a leader of public companies during the transition, and I would call it pre-Enron to post-Enron, which meant pre-Sarbanes-Oxley to after a lot of regulatory changes took place. And really, Sarbanes-Oxley created a whole new world and a whole new mindset where corporate America began focusing on the most important things and holding people accountable for the most important things, and got rid of a whole bunch of things that were maybe creating a lot of activity but not having a great impact. And the point I was making is I believe that that's exactly where the NCAA is right now. We're spending way too much time chasing down text messages and email messages and phone records and whether you have cream cheese on bagels, when we should be devoting the limited resources we have to those specific areas that are truly the most important and create the most risk in terms of competitive advantage and making sure that collegiate athletics stays the game and the high principled business that we all want to be in.
I also, you know, keep reminding everybody about how this model of intercollegiate athletics is really unique to the United States, where you combine an academic and a serious, we want it to be serious academic experience and opportunity for students, and also students who have enormous talent as a sport. I mean, they are gifted in that way. And so to give them the opportunity to do both, you don't find it anywhere else around the world. It is something that is very precious. And what I am constantly reminded about is it is not the excellence of the play on the field that is most important. It's the fact that we all know when we're watching a game that these are young people who are working on degrees, they are serious students, they're playing their hearts out, and they're doing it for their institution, and we're part of this big family watching it. It's very different from any other country and from professional sports, and it's what makes it so special, and it's what makes the fans so passionate about what's going on the field or the court. And we need to keep it the way it is. We're going to lose something really important if it becomes professionalized.
You're listening to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
And you're listening to a September 2011 conversation between the leaders of MSU and U of M, Michigan State University President Luana Simon and Spartans Athletic Director Mark Hollis are talking with their counterparts from Ann Arbor, University of Michigan President Mary Sue Coleman and Wolverines Athletic Director David Brandon.
I think we're really blessed to have the Big Ten as our conference with such strong principles and values regarding academics and the role of student athletes. They're very, very similar institutions, all academically difficult and all committed to student success.
I certainly agree with that. And, you know, it's interesting, Dave, I mean, from your perspective coming in, you're not quite 2 years now in the job. And even though you were a regent of the university and you knew a lot about it, I think there are things that you've learned about this as well and about the Big Ten.
Well, there's no question. And one of the things that you don't see until you kind of get inside the room is the collegiality and the spirit of cooperation that exists. I was really amazed by that because from outside, all you see are these incredible battles that take place on the court or in the pool or on the field, and there's such a competitive element to it. You don't realize that at the end of the day, we get in a room as athletic directors, and I know you do as presidents, and we try to do the right thing for the student athletes. We try to do the right thing for the various competitions that we hold, and we try to make this a great experience for those young people that come through our institutions. And sadly, some of our fans, I don't know about you, Mark, but I get a lot of advice from people who...
probably get much more advice than you did at your pizza company.
Oh, there's no doubt. I used to think people had strong opinions about pizza, but that was nothing. And some of these people just lose track. They just don't understand. These are 18 to 23-year-old young people who the vast majority of them will never make a living in the sport that they're competing in. They're here because they love the place and they want to display their talents, but they want to get a great education, and that's really what it's all about. And this passion for winning and this intense competition and all the stirring that takes place in the social media and talk radio, in some cases, just causes people to lose their perspective.
It really does. For every negative story out there, there's hundreds of positive stories in intercollegiate athletics. And from bringing a small child to practice that's struggling with brain cancer, and to see our student athletes interact with that child and give hope, and see Arthur Ray on his knees, encouraging her to fight the battle. It's just incredible the experiences that we get exposed to as athletic directors, and you try the best to get that information out to the public to inspire them. I think the things you're doing in Ann Arbor with all of your programs is phenomenal. The impact we have in Southeast Michigan from us playing a Final Four down there. It's just we have the ability to bring people together in positive environment, and it's important that we celebrate those and listen to the criticism, and I think we all do. It's just a matter of not letting that criticism control what we believe is the best direction for our student athletes, alums, and university.
If we could just get everybody to listen to the remarks that your quarterback made at the Big Ten luncheon and have them really carefully listen to what he said, the world would be a better place.
That's exactly right. I mean, these are young men, and they are trying their level best. Some days they're going to be great, and some days they maybe not be so great. But we've got to support them. We just have to. It's what's so good about what we're able to do. But, the other thing that I wanted to say is that I am really pleased about bringing Nebraska into the Big Ten. Here's a institution in a state that they are very passionate about their athletics. And we had an experience with them at the Alamo Bowl a few years ago when Lloyd Carr was still the coach. And as I recall, we lost that game, Dave. But you know what? The Nebraska fans were just the nicest. And it was just a great atmosphere. And so I'm expecting that they, when they come into East Lansing or come into Ann Arbor, and we go out there, that it's going to be a good experience too.
It's one of those crowds where you walk into, they are so educated about the game of football. And they respect both teams that are on the field like no other venue that I've been to. It's remarkable when you walk in. It's you are right, graciousness from the beginning to the end. And yet once you start that game, it's always a very competitive game in Lincoln.
Well, Dave, after you've done 2 years, so you think about doing this for a long time, what changes do you see outside of what we're trying to do right now and recalibrating the collegiate model for athletics? As you look forward and guiding Michigan athletics?
Well, from what I've seen in my first closing in on 2 years, I guess, is there's an insatiable appetite for investment in this area. it seems like every meeting I go to is at least $1 million meeting.
That's right.
But when you look at the sophistication and the things that are required in terms of facility, strength and conditioning support, you know, training equipment, the places that our teams want to go to compete to get better, the way that you have to pay great coaches if you want to, you know, attract them and retain them. It's an area where there is a tremendous amount of investment required if you want to compete at the highest level. And we want leaders and best at Michigan to be more than words of a fight song. We want to be leaders and best in everything that we do. And that's going to require us to mobilize our resources and be good stewards of those resources and make sure that we invest them wisely to create that environment that affords our student athletes the best chance of leaving here with a championship ring. That's what we want. We want them to get a great education and leave here with memories of what it's like to be a champion.
And as a business person, as you look at the marketplace and all of the things that are happening around us right now, it's a crazy time for intercollegiate athletics with the announcements of the day and conferences and other things. One of the questions that presidents have been dealing with is, how sustainable is all of this?
Well, I can tell you, based on our current status and our trend lines in terms of our projected revenues and the like, the business of big-time college athletics is very healthy. The fan interest is tremendous. There's a lot of energy around not just football, but basketball, hockey, all the things that are those sports that we rely on to generate a lot of revenue. Ticket prices are going up. They're not going down. And for the most part, we see huge opportunities ahead if we continue to run a really clean program that people can be proud of, that our donors want to invest in, and that people will continue to pay reasonable prices to come and see our young people perform. We really believe that the future is bright. We recently added two sports at the University of Michigan. We added men's and women's lacrosse. And so we're in a mode where, as opposed to shrinking and pulling in our horns, we're really out there investing and expanding our program for more reach and more opportunities for young people.
The one or the other thing I think is really critical here is how I think smart the Big Ten has been as a conference in positioning itself and in sharing revenues. You know, we've done this forever. This is not necessarily the way it goes across the country. And I think we've been really committed as a conference to making sure that people have resources across the conference, because we believe that good competition and within the conference is as important as anything that happens outside the conference. And so I like that strategy and that way that we've done it. And I think in our own sort of micro environments, I'm sure it's happening with you all in East Lansing. You've done some very innovative things about the venues that you've done for your big revenue sports. And of course, a lot of you've made investments that have been extremely important. And I see that happening across the Big Ten. And each of the institutions may be doing it in slightly different way, but I think this is a very healthy conference going forward, and I, like Dave, am very optimistic about the future.
I think we are in a terrific position, and the conference helps enormously with the changes that the NCAA may be going through, and I think it will put a premium on the conference's role as we have both a big tent for Division I, but still needing to deal with the differences across Division I in size of stadiums, the academic requirements, the whole range of things, and we need to declutter the rule book, so that means that conferences are going to play a stronger and stronger role.
Well, you know, I agree with that, and I'd like to believe that, you know, Dave is absolutely right about the fact that we need to do this with great integrity, great academic integrity. Once we if we lose that, then everything that's good about this whole construct of intercollegiate athletics goes away. And I think, you know, Luana, you and I both know how much the commissioner helps to guide that effort, reminds us all the time about how important it is, how important the behavior, the personal behavior of student athletes is, both on and off the field. And I think we've got the emphasis right where it should be. And I've been very pleased because now I've been associated with the conference. I was just thinking I'm going in on my 17th year as a president, either at Iowa or at Michigan. So I've seen a lot. I've seen a lot of evolution. And that part of it, that's what gives me confidence about the future.
Yeah, it is interesting that you know, our issues, our concerns are the same. They begin with the student and end with the student, as well as then developing a high quality experience for anyone who comes to our campuses to the best we can, recognizing that we're going to strive for perfection and as often is the case, fall a little short, but we're going to work very hard to make sure that people can be proud of both institutions.
I agree with you, absolutely. And I really view our collaboration. I just wanted to get back to the University Research Corridor a minute because, for me, that's been a very, very important development that you and I have been really pushing over the last few years. And we're doing a lot, but I think we can do a lot more. And I think this is one of those opportunities that the state has to make things happen in the state, but also to give the rest of the country a really good message about the research capacity that we have here in Michigan, which is among the top regions in the nation. And it's something that I think we can really help to change that economic future of the state for the better.
And not only have we weathered the economic storm, but there are instances in both campuses where our leadership internationally continues to grow, and we just need a 24-hour academic station to go with all these people talking about football.
There you go. That would be really good.
But apart from that, we're always proud of winning, but we're just more even more proud of the friendships we have with both of you and the way in which you make such a big difference for the state of Michigan. So thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
You're most welcome.
Thank you.
You're tuned to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
That was a September 2011 conversation between the leaders of Michigan State University and the University of Michigan. MSU President Luana Simon and Spartans Athletic Director Mark Hollis were chatting with U of M President Mary Sue Coleman and Wolverines Athletic Director David Brandon. To hear the conversation again, please visit SpartanPodcast.com.
The program is MSU Today. I'm Scott Westerman from the Michigan State University Alumni Association with some observations on the Spartan life. October at MSU is a month of career fairs. The Breslin Center and the fourth floor of Spartan Stadium Tower are filled with kids in dark business suits seeking their first career opportunity. I'm often asked how to create that initial business relationship that can be the launching pad for a profession. One of the best books on selling I ever read was The Accidental Salesperson by Chris Lytle. I love his maxim that we are most likely to build a profitable relationship with someone who aligns their behavior with the things that we value. Flip that around and you get the secret for choosing the right organization to partner with your personal brand. We are most likely to be successful in a company culture that is in sync with what we think is important. Whether you are starting your own business or looking for employment, these two ideas will be critical to your success and happiness. First, decide what you want to do and where you want to do it. Then, do your homework to become the best possible practitioner. I recently had a chance to visit with some of the recruiters who were on campus interviewing Spartans. What, I wondered, separated the winners from the rest of the field? Two things seemed to be common to every conversation. We are more impressed with people who understand what we do. Translation, do your research before you meet the customer. And we don't hire employees, we hire problem solvers. Translation, understand their challenges and be ready with solutions. These are two great ways to stand out in a crowd. When Colleen and I walk through the mall, I'm always fascinated by the people who work the cosmetic counters. The most successful seem to be artistic dermatologists. They know enough about the biology of our skin and the psychology of physical beauty to tell in an instant what will work best in our unique situation.
and they can size up a customer's psyche with good eye contact and a couple of well-chosen questions. Likewise, rockstar CEOs have a unique understanding of their customers, their competitors, and the dynamics of the marketplace. They rise to the top because they get the job done. They have a sixth sense for finding great talent and inspiring them to do great work. Want to have a leg up on your competition? Create a career game plan that includes these five ideas. Number one, bracket your passion. Hard work is much more fun when you love what you do. Number two, carefully select your partner. Build relationships with people and companies that share your values. Going to work is much more fun when you love the culture. Number three, do your homework. Become an expert and never stop learning about your work and your competitors. Keep adding to your skill set so you won't become obsolete. Number four, bring solutions. Come into every interaction with an idea. You are hired to help, so add value. And number five, execute. Life is about results. Deliver on your promises. Go the extra mile. Don't let setbacks deter you. The most important skill for standing out in a crowd is doing a little bit more than expected. Whatever your passion, you will be happiest when immersed in a challenge that stretches you, teaches you, and gives you the chance to solve a big problem. You will be the most successful when you have fully prepared for the task, can keep an open mind as you work, and stay with it until you get where you want to be. Sales, Chris Lytle writes, is a series of defeats punctuated by profitable victories. And so it is with our careers. Life is a series of problems punctuated by moments of joy and affirmation. You will definitely experience more lows when you decide to stand out from the crowd. But if you're working in your sweet spot with a company that shares your values, have done your homework, and are going the extra mile to deliver great value, you will discover that the joy is in the doing. As Seth Godin might say, creating great art is the cause. Success and happiness for you and everyone around you is the effect. I'm Scott Westerman, head servant at the MSU Alumni Association. Learn more about your personal network for life at alumni.msu.edu.
This is Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's your host, Dr. Kirk Heinze.
Well, let's begin this week's show by meeting a strong advocate for clean, renewable energy who was recently in Michigan to speak in support of the Michigan Ballot Proposal 3, which would amend the state constitution to establish a new standard for renewable energy, the so-called 25 by 25 proposal. Our guest is retired Vice Admiral Dennis McGinn, who now serves as the president of the American Council on Renewable Energy. Admiral, it's a great pleasure to meet you. Welcome to the show.
Kirk, thank you. It's really great to be with you here in Michigan.
Before we talk about 25 by 25 and the ballot proposal, and there's a lot of confusion surrounding that, a little bit about ACOR. You've been at the head of ACOR since 2011. What is your mission? What are some of your objectives?
ACOR's mission is to build a more secure and prosperous America with clean renewable energy. We do that by taking our 400-plus members that constitute the whole business community, if you will, of renewable energy, convene them, exercise some thought leadership, and help to advocate and educate for renewable energy. Its attributes are so fitting for Michigan, and that's why I'm here for to put my oar in the water, so to speak, an old sailor term,
right.
to help Proposal 3 pass.
This linkage between climate and national security and energy, and certainly in your career with the Navy, I mean, you had an opportunity to see this linkage firsthand. But why is that linkage so important, and why is that part of your key emphasis?
Well, from an ACOR perspective, we push the business aspects. It's just good business to deploy and scale up renewable energy of all sorts, solar, wind, biomass, geothermal, just tidal across the board. But there is this tremendous benefit environmentally. We've got an environment that affects us locally, regionally, and, of course, globally, and that's where climate comes in. Mm-hmm. I serve as vice chairman of this group called the CNA Military Advisory Board. It consists of about a dozen retired 3- and 4-star generals and admirals. And we did a report back in 2007 that was called Climate Change and the Threat to National Security. It was groundbreaking in that a lot of folks said, wait a second, these aren't environmentalists. These aren't big business trying to defend against environmental arguments. It was a national security voice that was basically saying that the severe weather effects of a warming planet will cause very fragile societies and fragile governments to fail because of that added pressure. And that effectively makes climate change a threat multiplier for instability around the world. And that's where the United States military will have to get involved more frequently, from things like humanitarian assistance, disaster relief, on up to potentially regional war as nations or societies compete for the basics of life because of long-term multi-year drought or because of floods and monsoon seasons that seem never-ending. So it really has been, I guess, verified by organizations like the Central Intelligence Agency, all of the military intelligence services, all of the militarily related think tanks that have said, yes, this is something that will change the future security environment, and we need to adapt to it. We need to mitigate the worst effects where we can, and if we can possibly prevent, that's important too.
You know, the interesting thing, Admiral, about that destabilization argument and the whole debate about climate change, you know, whether how much of it is human-induced and how much of it is natural, you know, that's sort of that argument becomes somewhat moot because the fact is climate is changing. What's causing it precisely maybe isn't as important as the fact that the climate is changing and is
right.
creating these destabilization factors.
Exactly, Kirk. And the way we put it on the Military Advisory Board, we were chaired at the time by retired General Gordon Sullivan, former chief of staff in the Army. And he said, we never have 100% certainty on the battlefield. In fact, if you wait for it, you're going to be in a lot of trouble. So we don't need 100% certainty about climate change. We don't need 100% certainty about what causes it. We just need to take a look at the indicators and warnings and do something about managing that risk and being able to deal with it in a lot of possible outcomes, just what we do in terms of military planning. So it makes a lot of sense for especially the United States as global leader to take actions to deal with this phenomenon called climate change, but to do it in a way that isn't stupid. And by that, I mean, we don't want to hurt our standard of living, our quality of life, and we don't want to hurt our economy. But there are so many things that we can do, like scaling up renewable energy for the good business purposes that we are doing it. And that is a very, very sensible way to proceed.
Well, good business purposes, good environmental purposes, and good national security purposes.
Absolutely.
As well.
It provides greater in energy security, for example. You hear a lot of discussion about we need an all-of-the-above energy policy. That's great. But in that all-of-the-above energy portfolio, we need elements that are more diversified than a primary dependence on fossil fuel. Coal in the case of Michigan and electricity production, oil in the case of all of the United States for transportation. So we need to take a look at each potential element of that all-of-the-above strategy, which will have fossil fuel and will have nuclear and will have renewable energy, and say, what are the fully accounted costs, benefits, and risks to each form of that, and then to make the right business decisions, the right political decisions based on that.
I want to talk about a couple of your specific ACOR programs, one of which I found particularly interesting was your work with the U.S.-China program.
Right. We have great companies, some Chinese companies, some U.S. companies that are in the business of renewable energy. And ACOR in our U.S.-China program brings these companies together to look for ways to partner to the benefit of the companies involved and the two nations involved. We don't take positions on trade barriers or taxes or tariffs or anything like that. We just bring together the right kinds of key people from the private sector and from government to have those conversations about what the best partnership mechanisms are going forward.
Yeah, and another one of your initiatives, regional roundtables, which have to do with energy policy and education on policy. you sort of suggest on your website, and correct me if I'm wrong, but maybe a regional energy policy or regional policies make more sense than one single, one size fits all?
They sure do. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've been trying for many years we in the United States, not we ACOR, but in the United States in the Congress, to pass things like a clean energy standard. And it does become, in some ways, a one-size-fit-all, which it doesn't. There are so many differences in different regions of the country about the resources that are available for renewable energy. For example, the obvious example is solar power tends to work a little bit better in the Southwest, in Arizona, California, New Mexico, than it does up in Maine, for example, in New England. On the other hand, biomass doesn't work so well in the desert Southwest. So the other aspect is the prices of electricity are different in different regulated regions of the country. And so we take that into consideration in these regional roundtables.
Well, speaking of regional, I mean, you were in Michigan recently to talk about a specific ballot proposal, which is 25% renewable energy by 2025. Now, there are pros and cons to this. This is a pretty controversial ballot proposal. Why are you supporting it? Michigan already has a renewable portfolio standard of 10% by 2015. Why do we need to ramp it up to 25 by 25?
Because it's Michigan, and Michigan can do so much better. Michigan is a great manufacturing state, great educated workforce, terrific infrastructure, a lot of entrepreneurs and innovators in the state. And Michigan, with a 25 by 25 standard, can lead the nation and not just do it for Michigan production of renewable energy, but be an exporter of not just the energy, but an exporter of the technology and that whole value chain of renewable energy. Michigan is already involved in many ways with the manufacturer of clean technology and making money at it and creating jobs at it. With a 25% renewable energy standard by 2025, that creates policy stability that entrepreneurs, investors, large and small, companies large and small, can count on, and they can make the needed capital investments to really create this business, this manufacturing value chain that will have market certainty. Nothing is worse for a potential investor than uncertainty. They hate it. So when you have a 25% standard out there to 2025 that's in the Michigan Constitution, it makes so much sense for industry to come to Michigan, for investment to come to Michigan, and really create this new energy economy starting right here that will benefit not only Michigan, but literally create a leadership role for the entire United States.
Now, this program has long been a supporter of renewable energy, but let me be the devil's advocate for this interview. What about the argument that even some proponents of clean energy are making, the argument that these costs for developing the wind and solar, the 25, are simply going to be passed on to the consumer by the power utilities, and that maybe we're at a time in Michigan when we just can't afford to do that?
I think Michigan is at a time where you can't afford not to do it. And in the language of the proposal, it caps any increase in utility rates to 1%. And that's a good protection for consumers, and it's a needed protection. But let me tell you about what's happening with the costs of renewable energy. Over the past 5 years, the cost of delivered electricity from wind power has come down more than 40%. In the case of solar, it's come down more than 75% over the same period of time, and the prices keep going down. As the deployment of renewable energy scales up, prices come down. It's the economy of scale. And this is happening all over the country, and it will happen in Michigan as well.
I was struck also in your background is high technology, and you've been involved with companies that produce high-tech software.
Right.
So you know how you know the innovation curve. You know it well.
Absolutely.
From personal experience. New technologies tend to cost more, but over time those costs go down. It's been shown over and over and over again. You say that's going to happen with alternative energy.
Absolutely.
It's already happening.
It already is happening. I talk to a lot of investors, from small venture capital companies to large international bankers, that are investing literally hundreds of billions of dollars in this space, and they're making a lot of money. They're not doing it to win an EPA Green Award.
No.
They probably will in some cases, but they're winning the green for their investors, and that is really, really key. It's a renewable energy is a real business, rapidly growing, and it has a lot of benefits to meet the energy challenges, the economic challenges, and the environmental challenges, not just at the global level like we were talking about before, but at the local and regional level. I talk around the country to a lot of folks about renewable energy, and so I say, how many people like electricity? Everybody loves electricity. Great standard of living, great economic growth. But then I say, well, how many people who like electricity would not mind living 5 miles downwind from a coal-fired power plant? Not too many takers
right.
on that.
Not in my backyard.
Exactly. Yeah. But yeah. the fact of the matter is coal-powered electricity has been very, very good to this country. But it's time to look for different ways to fill out that portfolio of energy requirements, and we have the technology to do it. We've got the investment capital to do it, and that's why the missing piece is a policy certainty that will be provided by Proposal 3 to create that 25% standard by 2025.
What can you say to our listeners about green job development? I mean, shadowy, real, or is it still sort of ambiguous?
Absolutely real. Mm-hmm. And these are real jobs, and they're jobs that create a catalyst effect in an economy, in a community that creates other jobs that support them.
Well, you've got a lot of good points about why people should support 25 by 25, but voters who are still on the fence, I mean, we've got a few seconds left here. I mean, what is the last thing you would like to leave the potential voters with respect to Proposition 3?
Don't be afraid of change. Don't let these tough economic times that we're slowly but surely climbing out of allow you to be paralyzed with fear. Embrace the future. The clean economy network, the clean economy is happening right now, and Michigan can really, really lead. Michigan has a great history of being bold. It was the arsenal of America back during World War II. It can be the arsenal of clean energy for this great country going forward.
Well, on that very positive note, I've been talking with Admiral Dennis McGinn, who serves as president of the American Council on Renewable Energy, or ACOR. Admiral, so good of you to be on the program. Thank you for your time. It's been a real pleasure.
It's been great being with you and with the great people of Michigan.
You're listening to Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Your host is Dr. Kurt Heinze.
Well, my next guest on Greening of the Great Lakes is Dr. Jennifer Lau, an assistant professor in the Department of Plant Biology at Michigan State University, whose research lab is located in the spectacular, lovely Kellogg Biological Station now down near Battle Creek, Michigan. Her research focuses on how plant populations respond to changing environmental conditions. Jennifer, a pleasure to meet you and welcome you to the program.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
You're doing a lot of different things. Before we get into some very interesting research you're doing with microbes, a little bit about your lab and this whole business of plants changing to environmental conditions. I assume maybe negative or deleterious environmental conditions like increased CO2 levels in the atmosphere?
Yes, often. So there's no doubt we're in a period of really rapid environmental change. And these environmental changes are affecting plant populations worldwide. So a lot of my research deals with how plants are negatively affected by some types of global change, like global warming. But sometimes global changes can have positive impacts on plants, too. So rising CO2 levels, that's basically plant food. They grow better, or most species grow better under elevated CO2. But we're really interested in understanding how plants evolve and adapt to these changing environmental conditions.
So we hear so much about rising levels of CO2 approaching or maybe passing 400 parts per million and how dangerous that is. But if I'm hearing you correctly, some of your research would suggest that maybe the results of those rising levels of CO2 have both deleterious and positive effects on plant populations.
Yes, that's true. So there are winners and losers. So some plants really respond positively to CO2, but then that, of course, increases competition on other plants that might not be able to take advantage of those rising CO2 levels.
Now, just from a layman's perspective, I would think that maybe rising levels of CO2 might have a greater negative effect on indigenous plants, and then you've got maybe some exotics coming in that maybe we shouldn't have that do pretty well with rising level CO2?
That's a great question. So there is some evidence that some of these negative species, whether they're exotic species or native pest species like poison ivy, actually do better under warmer conditions with higher CO2 levels. And there's this general idea out there that, global warming, that rising CO2 levels, all these global changes will facilitate invasive species. But there's not a whole lot of evidence in supporting that. So some of the work we're doing is looking at how things like climate warming affects native species versus invasive species.
You know, this is a little outside of the specific realm, but whenever I hear CO2 levels and global warming, we've had a lot of guests on the show. There's no question about the data in terms of the warming. I mean, I think virtually everybody will agree with that. Just from your perspective, and then we'll get into microbes, but in terms of human causality, I mean, where do you come down on that side of the equation? And I know it's a tough one, but are we responsible for some of these elevated levels of CO2, or are these primarily natural cycles we're going through?
Well, with regards to CO2, I think we're definitely contributing. I mean, if some of the main inputs are the burning of fossil fuels, agriculture, in terms of greenhouse gases, not just CO2, other greenhouse gases as well. So we're definitely increasing these greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. So I think it's pretty likely that humans are also responsible for at least a portion of the global warming that we're currently seeing.
And a good thing about that, if we're responsible for at least part of the global warming, then there's some things that we can do about it to mitigate that.
Exactly. Yeah. Yep. I think that's a positive spin on it.
Let's go back to the microbes and the things. Microbes are strange critters, and a lot of our listeners might not really know what they are, but they do have some they may be very helpful to plants based on some of your research in terms of adjusting to climate change. First of all, what are microbes and why are they so important?
So microbes are anything, very small organisms in the environment. Most of the microbes that we study are bacteria and fungi that live in the soil. And these microbes are really important to plants especially because they do a lot for the environment. They do a lot for the ecosystem. They're responsible for a lot of the important nutrient cycling that goes on, so they can make things like nitrogen more available to plants. They can help plants survive drought stress better. They can... some microbes even have the ability to fix atmospheric nitrogen. So most of our atmosphere is nitrogen, but it's all a form that plants can't use. But some microbes have the ability to take that atmospheric nitrogen and turn it into forms like ammonia and nitrate, things that plants need. So they do a whole variety of services for plants.
Historically, or you can correct me if I'm wrong, or traditionally, looking at plant responses to climate change, microbes were historically, I think, fair to say, rather ignored. But now they've become a major area of focus, not only in your research, but in a lot of other ways as well. Are unlocking the sequencing of microbes and things of that nature, I mean, is that the next great frontier in plant science?
I think so. So an area of the field called plant-soil feedbacks is gaining a lot of attention. And we know these interactions between plants and the microbes in the soil that they live with have a lot of impacts on community ecology, plant growth. And we used to refer to the soils as the big black box. We just didn't know what was underneath there. But now with these genomics, metagenomics approaches, we can actually start to understand who are these microbes and try and figure out what are they doing.
Now, from a practical standpoint, our listeners are out there saying, okay, so you unlock all the sequencing of these microbes. You begin to understand them. Science advances along the microbial front. What are the practical implications for plant populations that might resonate with our listeners?
Okay, so practical applications. So one of the things that Dr. Jay Lennon's and my research shows is that these changes to the below-ground microbial communities, so changes to which microbes are present, can really protect plants from drought stress. So if we grow plants with a microbial community adapted to drought conditions, drought has minimal effects on plant growth and fitness. If we grow plants with their normal microbes, drought severely reduces fitness by about 60%. So it suggests that these microbes have a rapid ability to adapt to new environmental conditions. And so maybe these rapid changes in the microbial communities can help plants survive changing environments. The historical view is kind of that you know, plants either have to migrate to escape environmental conditions or changing environmental conditions, adapt. And what our research shows is that they have this third option. They can kind of rely on the below-ground microbes to help them out.
Well, this may really be a stretch, but if microbes have this ability to adjust and adapt and to help plants in drought resistance, for example, mm-hmm. Is it possible then down the trail maybe to actually treat soils in arid parts of the world to add microbes and take microbes away in order to enhance plant growth?
Ah, that's a really interesting idea. So possibly. I mean, there are companies now that actually sell microbes, right? And you can buy microbes at your local lawn and garden supply store and help your trees grow better. And they're basically mycorrhizae or a common mutualist with plants. So some companies are starting to do that on a limited scale. Doing it on a larger scale is who knows whether it could work or not. We just don't know.
Well, I'm talking with Jennifer Lau, who is an assistant professor in the Department of Plant Biology at Michigan State University, whose work is done down at the MSU's Kellogg Biological Station, and it's funded in part by MSU Ag BioResearch. What are some things on the horizon for you and your team now, in addition to the microbial stuff? Any other exciting new work that you're doing?
Well, the project that I'm most excited right now is also dealing with microbes, and it's dealing with a really important mutualism between plants in the legume family, like soybeans and peas and green beans, and a specific type of microbe called rhizobia. Rhizobia are one of those bacteria that can take atmospheric nitrogen and fix it into forms that plants can use. And this mutualism is super important. Before the Industrial Revolution, it was responsible for most of the nitrogen in terrestrial communities. So a really big player in the ecosystem. Now, with all sorts of nitrogen deposition that's going on, nitrogen deposition is a global problem. It's actually shifting this mutualism more towards parasitism. So it's causing the microbes to evolve to be closer to parasites than to mutualists. And it's kind of an unthought of negative evolutionary effect of nitrogen deposition that's shifting this really important mutualism more towards parasitism. So that's where some of our research is going right now.
And that's not that parasitism. I mean, just looking at that on a global scale, if that indeed is the case, I mean, it means that there are things societies may have to do, or science, in conjunction with public policy to reverse that trend.
Yeah. I mean, in this particular case, what it may end up doing is increasing our reliance on synthetic fertilizers. And synthetic fertilizers are really expensive. They're economically costly, and they're also energetically costly to produce. And so if we're reducing the amount of nitrogen contributed to the system by this really important mutualism, we're going to have to depend on those synthetic fertilizers more.
Well, as in many other great issues that are confronting us these days, I mean, eventually the science will prevail. And Lau's labbies down there at Kellogg Biological Station will be major contributors to that effort. I've been talking with Jennifer Lau, assistant professor in the Department of Plant Biology at Michigan State University. Jennifer, thanks so much for being on Greening of the Great Lakes.
Thanks. It was really fun.
Visit us online at SpartanPodcast.com.
Thank you for listening to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Please visit us online at SpartanPodcast.com and join us every Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock for MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.